There has been a lot of talk recently about the Constitution in our land, with frequently voiced concerns about a looming constitutional crisis. Many legal scholars and editorial writers seem to think we're in the midst of such a crisis, though they don't always agree on who bears the blame for the problem. I read someone's comment recently that it feels like we're watching a bad train wreck, only this time we're on the train. The anxiety level is high, and it does feel as though the future of our republic somehow hangs in the balance. One wonders if we'll ever find our way back to the civil society we have long sought to be. Will we be able to reclaim our footing as a nation that, for all of its stress on individual dreams and individual success, nonetheless has long valued the common good as a goal and noble ideal? Will we be able to rediscover a politics where reason and respect and truth hold the higher ground? Will we be unified enough again to reclaim the vision embodied in the preamble to the Constitution? I learned that preamble back in my 9th grade civics class. It's not a perfect document, to be sure, and I know we've not lived up to its ideals, but I still find it remarkable. I imagine some of you could say it with me. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. It seems to me that several of those preambular assumptions have been all but forgotten in today's America, where the common good is commonly ignored or even disdained, and the blessings of liberty seem to be accorded to some but not to all. The preamble records our founders' vision for America and their hope for the kind of citizenry that would populate the land. It's a hope that seems to have lost its clarity in the current political landscape. And to be honest, I find myself a bit homesick for the country I had thought we were becoming. I say all this as a prelude to sharing an observation I came across this week while revisiting the Beatitudes that Becca just read for us, namely one biblical scholar's assertion that the Sermon on the Mount is, in some powerful ways, Christianity's constitution. And if so, then the Beatitudes are its preamble. He says the Beatitudes proclaim what is, in the light of the kingdom of heaven, unassailably true. They describe the purpose of every holy law, the foundation of every custom, the aim of every practice in this new society, this colony of heaven, this church called and instructed by Jesus. In these fraught times, I can think of no more important text for the church to consider than those Beatitudes. The Beatitudes are our preamble, our mission statement, as it were. These 9 sentences are not statements of conventional sociological wisdom, but rather radical assertions about the nature of human life within the providence of God. Jesus challenges his hearers to readjust their way of thinking about reality, about life, about God. He says things in truth are not what they seem. It becomes quickly apparent, says Tom Long, that the Beatitudes turn the world's values upside down. If we were to take them seriously, they would turn our political landscape upside down, too. What is true for those who live in the power of the kingdom of heaven is a flat reversal of what is considered to be true in the culture at large, says Barbara Brown Taylor. The Beatitudes declare that the poor in spirit and the meek and the peacemakers are the ones who are truly blessed. We live in a world, of course, that pronounces such benediction over the self-sufficient and the assertive and the power brokers. The people whom the world would see as pitiful, the mournful, the persecuted, are the very people Jesus claims are truly joyful and blessed. No one with a lick of sense was going to vote for any of these definitions of the good life, but Jesus didn't ask for anyone's approval. He simply redefined the good life in 9 short sentences and held them out for everyone to see. 9 portraits of kingdom people who were previously known as victims, dreamers, pushovers, and fools. These are the chosen ones, he said, the saints, the blessed ones who will see God face to face. They are the happy ones, ones who will be satisfied, not because they got an advanced copy of the rules and played by them to win, but because winning was the farthest thing from their mind. The subtle use of verb tenses in the Beatitudes is not unimportant here. Each one of them begins in the present tense. Blessed are. In other words, those who are blessed are joyful now, in the present. 6 of the Beatitudes, however, offer some specific reasons for such blessedness that are not located in the present, but the future. Tom Long says this indicates that the church, the community of Christ, is a joyful people, but the source of their joy is not that they live easy lives in a happy world, or that things are getting better day by day by day, but that their trust is in God's realm, God's kingdom, which is coming. That is to say, the church always sees its life in 2 different frames of reference. First, it sees what everyone else sees, a world and a nation and it's a struggle and pain and injustice where innocents suffer, where so-called leaders demonize people because of their race or their religion or their national origin or their sexuality or their gender. Based on what we see, there's not a lot of reason for hope or joy there. War follows upon war. Violence begets more violence, and the poor and the innocent suffer every day. But the church, by standing on its head, as it were, also has a second frame of reference. For it sees what others don't see, that God is at work in this world even today and will surely bring the world to a time of joy and peace. Such confidence enables people of faith to live in the present time, aware that they are blessed, despite everything that would assert the contrary. Now, I want to be clear. This is not some you'll get your reward later sort of faith. Christian life, discipleship, and hope is very much rooted in the present as well as the ultimate future. Jesus is not inviting anyone in these Beatitudes to become victims. He's not calling us to seek persecution for ourselves, or grief, or even poverty of spirit, as though by doing so we could somehow earn a place in God's realm. Rather, Jesus is offering assurance and strength to all those who find themselves in a position of weakness, or poor in spirit, or mourning, or hungering for righteousness, that they know God's heart. Perhaps the best way to understand Jesus' words here is as an imparting of grace. He is assuring those who are in pain or experiencing deprivation of spirit, or those who find it difficult to follow God's commands, or those who are broken in any way, that God is right with them precisely where they are hurting or struggling. One theologian acknowledges that to those who live outside the church's faith, the Beatitudes may seem to be nothing more than the absurd delusion of sentimental minds. But to those who have wept in the arms of a sister or brother, to those who have tasted compassion, to those who have committed themselves utterly to God, the Beatitudes are the captions of life that reveal a wild, extravagant, unceasing love that breaks upon this world from the very heart of heaven. In and through our hunger and our sorrow, we know what the world cannot figure out, that we are indeed blessed. Now here's the rub. If we believe the Beatitudes are indeed the preamble to our Christian faith, then we may find ourselves thinking that we don't measure up to their high expectations. And if we speak only individually, such worries might have some validity. New Testament scholar Gene Boring concedes that not every member of every congregation can claim to be meek. We know a few others. Not everyone can claim to be merciful. Not everyone can be pure in heart. But the Beatitudes are addressed not initially to individuals. They're addressed to the whole faith community. Among every authentic Christian community of faith can be found persons of meekness, ministers of mercy, and workers for peace, all forms of saints. Their presence and their activity among us are signs of God's blessing and a call to all of us to conform our common life more and more to these kingdom values. In community, you see, our own faithfulness is multiplied. In his first letter to the church in Corinth, the Apostle Paul reminded the Christians there that they were called to be saints together with all those who in every place called on the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. Called to be saints, not by ourselves individually, but together. On this All Saints Sunday, we are especially aware of such connections, not only with Christians in every place, but also with the faithful of every time, those who have sought and those who seek still to uphold the Constitution of the Church and embody its preamble, the mourners, the peacemakers, the righteousness seekers, the mercy bearers, saints together. In this congregation, our saints include the faithful who have gathered for worship on this site and its antecedents as far back as 1716 and as recently as this morning. Our saints include those whose names we called as we saw them across this room this day, and those whose names we will tearfully speak during the great prayer, and all those whose names are all but forgotten except to God. Our saints are all those who live in God's light, whose lives are willing to try by God's constitutional promises to live, all who embrace a world turned upside down by the claim of this one who is, after all, the only one who really knows which way is up. That we have been called to such faithfulness together with all those saints is a great source of comfort. And it's a great challenge. If we will but claim our connection for this time and this place, their solidarity with us can be a source of considerable courage at a time when we may need it most. Indeed, together with Christ, together with the saints, we can still turn this world right side up. We can, you know. We can. And God knows we surely should. We simply must.